What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
As a scientist, we tend to hate observer effects, meaning by virtue of taking a measurement, you can change the experiment just by looking. Have you heard of like Schrodinger's cat, dead or alive? Well, you only know if you look. So in a lot of situations, by observing, you actually change it. And so again, scientists and controlled experiments, they try and avoid this. But really, what I see as bad for scientists or experiments, I see as excellent for people who want to make changes like this. What ends up happening, that by virtue of paying attention to things, the stuff you do that tends to harm you, that stuff goes down. And the stuff you do that tends to help you, it goes up.
I'm Doug Bopst, personal trainer, best-selling author, and entrepreneur, and I'm on a mission to help others become the best version of themselves. So I'd like to welcome you to the Adversity Advantage podcast, where we will help you use obstacles, failures, and setbacks to give you that edge needed for success. I'll be interviewing people from all walks of life on how they overcame trials and turned them into triumphs. So please sit back, relax, and get ready to be absolutely blown away by some of the wisdom and stories you're about to hear.
Welcome back to another episode of the Adversity Advantage. I'm your host, Doug Bopst, and today's guest is Dr. Trevor Cashy. Dr. Cashy is a leading expert in the fields of nutrition, fitness, and human performance. Dr. Cashy has a very unique background as he has expertise in things like biochemistry, physiology, and behavior change. Dr. Cashy has dedicated his career to helping humans from all walks of life optimize their health and performance. Today on the show, we discuss the real reason why most people don't lose the weight that they want, the number one thing you must do before you get started on your weight loss journey, how to effectively modify your behavior to get the results that you want, how to properly build momentum to become healthier and lose weight, how to finally eliminate your excuses and find time to get healthy, the skills you should focus on so that you can master your health journey, how to build healthy habits that last, how to navigate social media for nutrition advice, and so much more. So let's get this conversation going and welcome Dr. Trevor Cashy to the Adversity Advantage podcast.
I'd love to start off with what you believe is the number one thing that keeps people from losing weight when they want to.
Oh, so I will start with the most obvious and irritating answer. Consuming more calories than you expend on average over time tends to turn into the largest interfering factor of weight loss from the sort of annoying physiological perspective. But I know that we will go a little bit deeper than that. So I'll let you fire back with a little more specificity on your end as far as like what sort of things, like from a behavioral perspective perhaps, or from like what sort of perspective of an answer would you like for that question? Because I think we could go pretty much any direction there, man.
Well, I think there's this idea that exists that you have to blame a specific food for the reason you're not losing weight. It's carbs, it's sugar, it's this. I'm not fasting long enough. When really, like you said, like that's the biggest thing that matters is controlling how many calories you eat. So I would love to explain why it's not necessarily like carbs, sugar, etc. And it really is calories.
Very good question. And thank you for sort of managing that response well, because I know that it kind of like hits a wall sometimes. I'd like to start out with that just to frame set a little bit, because I do differentiate very heavily between like what people consider healthy and the difference between healthy stuff and then gaining and losing weight. Because although they have obviously interrelated things, I do see them separate and interrelated. That body weight by and large does have an effect on health status, and health status to some degree has separate features from weight status, and weight status to some degree has separate features of health status. So in the context of just pure body weight, especially in the context of like stores like muscle mass and bone and fat more specifically, that almost entirely comes from what I call metabolizable carbon. And so when you eat stuff, the stuff you eat has carbon and you consume carbon. Like when you breathe out, we know we breathe in oxygen and we breathe out carbon dioxide. That stuff we breathe out, that carbon dioxide we breathe out comes from the food we ate, which I find frankly pretty cool. Kind of like the reverse of what photosynthesis does. And in that situation, it really helped me personally that we store, effectively store that carbon, those calories, and though that carbon can come from anything that has metabolizable carbon in it. It can come from zucchinis, it can come from sugar, it can come from chicken breast, it can come from anything that we consider either healthy or toxic or unhealthy. And I just take the position that if you eat a lot of that stuff, really no matter what stuff, in principle, you can end up eating more metabolizable carbon than you expend. And therein lies a sort of question about like health and things of that nature from like the healthy lifestyle, longevity, like micronutrients, things like that. Although I want to make very clear that the body weight, by and large, just comes from the calories you consume compared with the calories you expend, which we expend them for in a variety of different ways.
Diving more into the calories in, calories out, one of the things that a lot of my clients over the years have had a hard time with is figuring out how much they need to eat and figuring out how much they're actually eating. And it's not just from a methodology standpoint. It's more from busy as heck. I don't have time to weigh my food. I don't have time to, you know, look at my fist and see if that matches up with a piece of chicken or whatever the example is. And so it just becomes easier just to mindlessly eat or to eat, you know, packaged foods and stuff like that. Maybe we can see where we go with this, but talk a bit about how somebody can discover like how much food they should be eating on a daily basis if the goal is weight loss.
Oh, I love this question. And especially with the sort of interfering factors with paying attention. And when working with somebody one-on-one, et cetera, I love to have the sort of conversation of like, well, what things in your life do you pay a lot of attention to? A lot of people, for instance, they will check and see how much money they have in their bank account regularly. They check to see how much gas they have in their gas tank. They check to see how fast they ran that mile or how much weight they have on the bench press. And so looking, you know, from a practical perspective, what sort of actual things interfere with becoming aware of what you do? And if we have sort of realistic logistical interference, like skills or tools, et cetera, or if we kind of know that if we look, we might have a problem with what we see. And differentiating between those things kind of helps take the next step between like, I really have zero clue what to do. And that does make it a hassle because learning new things, like a little bit of neophobia, a little bit of hassle of acquiring new skills versus I know that I will look at this and feel ick. So I will avoid doing that stuff. And I will say things that people will agree with in order to avoid doing it.
Like as you're saying this, and as just thinking about my career in the fitness space, I just think that people have a hard time just figuring out some simple steps that they can take to start to have a better understanding on not only like, you know, what they're eating, why they're eating certain foods. And I always say to people, like, if you don't have any the self-awareness around your food, you can blame sugar, you can blame carbs, you can blame this or that. None of that matters until you understand like why you're doing certain things. And a lot of times when they're coming to people, at least from my understanding, they're not coming to me when things are good. They're coming to me when they can't figure things out and they haven't been doing good for a long time. And so how can somebody begin to get the ball rolling just a little bit to have a better relationship with food so that they can reach whatever goal they want?
Okay, understood. You brought up a great point with kind of people coming when they have the issue. Like, you know, people seek help when they have a problem to solve. And so you set it up with a great point. I think by and large, when working with a professional or otherwise or trying to work with yourself, people tend to try and change a few too many things at the same time. And so when you have this, you know, work out an hour every day, eat tuna and twigs six times, measure this, take this pill, et cetera, I really just try to narrow down for myself specifically that I also put really awareness as just the number one skill to have. That before you change your exercise, before you change what you eat, before you change the timing, before you take supplements, before you do any of that stuff, you just look at what you already do. And so by and large, when we look at these interfering factors that you discuss, I think a lot of those interfering factors actually come from, well, I want to change what I eat, when I eat, how I eat, what I take, all this stuff happens at the same time. And I guarantee that if you just change the one thing, you just pay a little bit extra attention deliberately with what you eat, even for a week or 10 days, that will more than get the ball rolling. And in a lot of cases, you can see enough results just paying attention a little bit more and deliberately, that alone will act as a sufficient intervention to like have, you know, very positive effects on health and body composition for sure. So I just see it as eliminate everything else I can get in the way, especially in the context of health and fitness that people typically talk about, and just like keep everything else the same. Just keep track of what you already do.
And so how does somebody take that information and use it in a way that can effectively create change moving forward?
Understood. So in this situation like this, have you ever heard of the term observer effect?
I have not.
Okay, so in science, as a scientist, we tend to hate observer effects, meaning by virtue of taking a measurement, you can change the experiment just by looking. Have you heard of like Schrodinger's cat, dead or alive? Well, you only know if you look. And so in a lot of situations, by observing, you actually change it. And so again, scientists and controlled experiments, they try and avoid this. But really, what I see is bad for scientists or experiments, I see as excellent for people who want to make changes like this. Because what ends up happening, that by virtue of paying attention to things, the stuff you do that tends to harm you, that stuff goes down. And the stuff you do that tends to help you, it goes up. And so often, just vigilant tracking, that works well enough as a standalone intervention, because as soon as you start to notice the smart stuff that you do more, or the smart stuff you do too little, and the dumb stuff that you do too much, those things start to shift on their own just by virtue of watching. And so yes, the original question of like, how do you use that information to help? And I take the position a vast, vast, vast majority of the time, the observer effects, just paying attention by its own, it automatically modifies your behavior towards your values. And so when you start getting longitudinal data, or you start collecting data over time, you will have proof that, well, I do this helpful stuff more. And when I do this helpful stuff more, I get these good results. And when you get these good results, it prompts you to do that helpful stuff even more, a little positive reinforcement. And at the same time, when you also realize the silly stuff you do that harms, either immediately or at a delay, and you accumulate that information over time, you will also start to do that less automatically. If you have that value of wanting to live a healthier lifestyle or personal development or whatever sort of values that you hold, as soon as you start making yourself deliberately aware of the things that help it and interfere with it, the ball will at least start rolling on its own. And often, and I mean this seriously, it gets the ball rolling enough that a lot of times it will snowball. And then you will make significant progress on your own. And then when you do start to hit the next sort of plateau, then you can even take the next step to make, you know, more personalized or more deliberate, intense changes to your diet and exercise pattern. If you measure your steps, which a lot of phones do, and then you actually look at the data over time and you say, whoa, that equals 2,000 or 3,000, it will start to tick up on its own a little bit if you have an inherent understanding that step count will end up helping you. And so again, I take the position that it gets a little intimidating to say, well, I've accumulated all this data, what do I do? And that question tends to come before people have accumulated the data. And just by virtue of measuring one thing that has some relationship with where you want to go, your behavior will modify on its own in the direction of your intention.
People often will wait until crisis happens to make a behavior modification or care about the behavior modifications that we're talking about. And I think what you're saying is spot on, but I think somebody listening to this might be like, well, it's easier said than done, because maybe I don't like exercise. I'm not in the position right now where I really quote unquote care enough about my health to make it a top priority, but I want to get healthier. And I think a lot of times people fall into this trap where they know they need to get healthy, but it doesn't become a top priority for them. It's not a top value for them because they have so much else going on. When you're working with somebody, it seems like you have a very nuanced approach when you're coaching people. I know you can't change somebody. Like, you can't change me to care about science, right? You can't change me to want to move to XYZ state. That said, how do you coach somebody along the journey to get them excited about wanting to change their health so that they don't wait for a heart attack or something to come along?
Understood. Yes, I agree that these sort of traumatic events make behavior plastic, right? So you bring up an interesting question. Again, lots of, like, good. Thank you for these. In a situation like that, I rely on what I call a commitment device. And so in a situation like that, we all kind of know that, like, some stuff we avoid, sometimes that stuff sucks. And I know that people who have tons of stuff going on, they do a lot of stuff, even though it sucks. And so I love to have the conversation of what this makes any more suckier than that. How do you know? And what sort of wiggle room do we have in here? Again, I might ask a different way and incorporate some of their personal information. In either case, the commitment device plays a huge role for a variety of reasons. When I say commitment device, I define commitment as the deliberate elimination of alternatives. For instance, when somebody goes to work with a professional, that professional tends to cost money. And so when you have an initial conversation with somebody and you come to an agreement on the goal and what we want to do, at least initially, to get the ball rolling, you tend to agree on some sort of cost. And so for a person that does this professionally, that cost, that money the person pays, acts as the initial commitment device for the other person. And this occurs mostly because of negative reinforcement. In other words, the person gives you money, and to avoid that ugly feeling of wasting that money, they do at least a little bit of what the professional suggests. And so that turns your job as a professional of starting the clock as soon as they become a client and going, I have a matter of 15 interactions I have with this person to take full advantage of this commitment period where this person now has a higher probability of doing what I say because they want to avoid wasting their money. And that turns into one of the most important periods that a professional has when starting with a new client, because that gives you the opportunity to work with that person to do things that gets them good results as fast as possible so that you can generate that excitement. And so if we know by and large that, you know, gym memberships might last anywhere between 60 and 90 days, something of that nature. And so if we sort of, you know, arbitrarily slap that timeline over to somebody working with a professional and you check in with that person maybe once a week, it means, frankly, you got like between 8 and 10 interactions working with that person, if you do once a week check-ins, of higher probability of getting that person to do something different than they normally would, helping them learn how to track that data and interpret the data they get to show inside of that period. Holy crap, look at all the progress you just made. And that will end up getting the ball rolling beyond the initial commitment device of the purchase. So you have this time period where, okay, a person does stuff to try and prevent wasting money. Let's get real. You just now, as a professional, have to gear as much of your education and intervention as you can to get as good a result as possible in that time period that people tend to fall off when they have nobody helping them, so that when what a marketer might call the pain of purchase goes away, you have accumulated enough evidence to keep the ball rolling beyond that, and you develop rapport. They start getting excited about the progress they make, and then you can look further into the future from a practical perspective. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And for the sake of the conversation, if somebody's listening to this and maybe they can't afford to hire a coach and they just want to figure out, like, what can I do to make sure that I stick to this long term? Like, how can I get excited about something? And we've talked about that essentially, I mean, I believe whether or not you're working with a coach or not, results matter. Like, you have to see progress in order to continue to stay motivated, excited, et cetera, with what you're doing. But you also can't bite off more than you can chew. Like we also talked about a few minutes ago, where if you're like, all right, I'm going to try to extend the time without food. I'm going to cut out this. I'm going to incorporate that. I'm going to strength train. I'm going to walk. I'm going to do all these things. You're going to set yourself up for failure as well. If you had to provide the listeners with a few tips, if they're starting off on this journey, to not bite off more than they can chew, but also some simple things that will help them see results in a somewhat quick way so that they can stay motivated, What kind of things would you say to them?
I will, man, I have done this for too many years to waver too much. And I will do whatever humanly possible to encourage paying attention to what you do, to track what you do. If a person wants to improve their spending habits, what do?
They keep a budget, right? Or they have a tracker on their phone. Yeah.
Right. If a person wants, so when it comes down to it, the sort of lore in the public discourse for the more popular, more influential people makes it look like you do one weird trick and weight goes away. And why does that only ever happen with nutrition? And it never, like, one weird trick and your bench press goes up 200. Not really. One weird trick and $1 million appears in your, no, not really. One weird trick and your CE, not really. And so a lot of it comes down to like this, again, having an honest conversation with yourself of like, well, if I can't afford, if I have so much going on that I can't walk, I'm so poor that I can't pay for a call with somebody like you or somebody like me or somebody else who cares, and I don't give a crap about it, this creates a very interesting sort of confluence of things that would honestly justify a different sort of conversation. So I have yet to meet a person that has so much going on. I really have yet to meet a person with that much going on. I see it as a common response to a person has to avoid doing something new, a legitimate one. Well, I got way too much going on to do that. Well, you have enough time to have this conversation. I really just get into the details that when people avoid doing things that they want to avoid, right? They end up leaning on vagaries. They end up leaning on affective emotional language. They end up leaning on cognitive bias. They end up leaning on all of this language. Like, it's other people to agree, yeah, don't do that. And I just refuse, brother. I just refuse. I care way too much to let a person say, I got too much going on. I'll say, okay, let's lay out your day. Every 15 minutes, you tell me what you do. Or take the next week and do a time study and show me exactly what you do. Just write down what you do. If you have so much to do, you have a problem writing a sentence every 30 minutes about what you do. We have something totally different going on. Fortune 500, you know what I mean? Like, just these sorts of very interesting sort of linguistic judo, this mental gymnastics that people play with themselves and people that care about them. I just refuse to play the game, so to speak. Now, a lot of people do this sort of reflexively because as soon as they get approached or confronted with something that bugs them, they press all of these buttons to avoid that thing. And instead of agreeing, I just ask for data. And in other words, can you prove, like, I want to know how busy you get. I find this fascinating that you work 20 hours a day and have problems paying $3 for this extra stuff. So like, in other words, maybe I could help you budget. Like, something has, like, the math, something ends up getting weird with the math when you use sort of dramatizing language, downing yourself, acting demanding with yourself and others. This sort of, like, again, we just have these sort of reflexive responses that we use to avoid stuff when we get confronted with it. And I just like to call it out, man. Does that make sense?
Sure. Because I think we're always looking for an excuse as to why we can't achieve something, whether it's time.
And we get a lot of other people to agree when we do it. And that makes it kind of addictive.
I think one of the other things that plays a part in all of this is people's relationship with themselves. You know, it's like a lot of times these are just projections or deflections of, because they feel so poorly about themselves. Maybe they've been trying diets for 20 years that have never worked. Maybe they've been, you know, attacked for the way they look for years or bullied in childhood or whatever the example is, that they see themselves a certain way and they're coming into the journey from a place of fear, from a place of scarcity, from a place of just not feeling like enough. How would you convince somebody to have a better relationship with the journey instead of it being this painful thing that they must do every single day?
Yeah, dude, the should, must, have to, or else. That stuff gets real gnarly, and it gets people, it stimulates people. I will just say that, you know? One of my favorite frames I like to use the child frame a lot. A lot of people, and rightfully so, will refer to essentially previous experience in their lives. You know, bullied as a kid, issues with parents, and other, you know, traumatic experiences, et cetera. And I like to compare or work with them to compare then to now. And for a vast majority of the time, I just sort of lay out the question, do you let 6-year-old you make decisions for 36-year-old you? Like, did this set off a chain of events that led to some, I'll just call it for the sake of our conversation, hassles in your life that recur? Maybe. I also take the position that what originally caused an issue differs from what maintains the issue right now. And so, yes, you had a crummy things happen a long time ago, or even relatively recently, but those things have zero effect, practically speaking, on you right now. And so this goes back to the conversation I like to have with people about permission of, do you let 6-year-old you make decisions for 36-year-old you? And it creates an interesting sort of vibe because in a lot of places in our lives, no, I do keep a budget. I do show up to work on time. I do brush my teeth. I do this. You do a lot of adult things. And in a lot of the areas or domains of our lives where we have a lot of trouble, we tend to lean on these previous experiences as a way to, by and large, give ourselves permission to avoid the stuff that would help us. And although, yes, that did occur, I like to think about, well, if you overate last night a lot, like you binge ate and you hate yourself, absolutely, I'd ask the question, how does the event 30 years ago cause that? And it creates a good conversation between us because something occurred that day or an hour before or 10 minutes before. And some modification in the environment occurred, some activating event that led to this other chain of thoughts, of feelings, of actions that raised the probability you binge ate. And then a way to avoid realizing it or not, so literally analyzing that chain of events that day leading up to that point, we can then go back to this previous ugly experience way, way early in our lives as a realistic way to avoid looking at the facts as they presented in the moment the event occurred. So I hope that kind of gives you an idea of like this sort of, I care about a person's presence in the moment, aware of what they do when they do it, and then really looking at the surrounding events that contribute to the probability of this behavior occurring. And although, yes, I do agree that these ugly experiences in our lives do have formative effects on our behavior right now, that happens if we passively let previous experiences govern our lives. And we can recognize and respect that a previous ugly experience affects us now. And we can also recognize and respect that we can accumulate the correct amount of evidence, make informed decisions, and use the information we collect in the moment to make ourselves better. Because really, brother, this comes down to learning. Like every single person I have spoken to 100% of the time, when tangentially or otherwise, says that they can learn things. And learning really means going into the same situation again and doing something different. At least I define learning that way. And so I try to look at what sort of interfering factors do we have with learning. So putting it in that frame, previous experiences in our lives, ugly interactions we've had with our friends, family, spouses, etc. These things can interfere with our learning, interfere with our ability to do a different thing when the same situation presents. And so I also like to come from that frame of what interfering factors do we have? Have you tied your shoelaces together? That makes it hard to run a marathon, so to speak.
We've spent a lot of the conversation so far talking about learning, developing self-awareness, asking yourself better questions to be able to prioritize things that are important to you. And let's just say that the person, somebody's listening to this and they're like, got it, Dr. Kashi, like I'm going to make time in my calendar. I'm going to start paying more attention to what I eat, to what I drink. I care about that enough that I want to have the awareness around that. And I, at the same time, I also want to keep the snowball going in a manageable way and implement different nutrition habits into my life that are going to be good for me for longevity, the way I feel about myself, but it's not going to make me miserable to follow this. What are a few things that you would have somebody start with if they've got the self-awareness down and they're looking to make some shifts in the way that they eat?
I love it. I love it. So I will tell you, I prioritize above all else, really like you discussed, the, you know, keeping track of, but getting awareness of what you actually do and when, and then getting some results that way. And even at that point, I still put body mass in general fitness, by and large, I put that way further ahead than many of these other sort of nuanced interventions with, you know, get this many milligrams of micrograms of selenium or make sure to get this sort of food at this time or whatever. And even the next step after really just getting skilled at collecting data, I then move on to developing the skill of managing how much you eat with what you already eat. So even here, I still stand back to do what you all like, eat the foods you already eat. By and large, you already eat things you like. And so now, instead of eating things you like and having them make your life worse, I would rather have you eat things you like and have it make your life better.
Right, right, right.
Even still, it just goes back to, can we establish better patterns? So once you get awareness of what you eat, you can still eat the same stuff. Now we just look at improving the skills of developing better or more effective eating patterns with the foods you already eat. That will then also get you to the next step of the way. And then after that, we would focus a little bit more on your protein. And all of these things, in a stepwise fashion, will keep the progress going and also help catch you up with, you know, skill development will go up as you do these things. And as your skill development goes up, your progress ends up going up. And these things, from a sort of pedagogical, from a skill development standpoint, you can stretch out this progress for well over a year. And a lot of people take way less than that to get the sort of results that they want to get to improve their health at a reasonable level. And so if you get to a point where, like, now I've built the skill of getting aware and keeping track of data, and now I developed better patterns with foods I already like, with stuff I already eat, and now I get a little bit more protein in than I used to if I have pretty low protein, then we focus more on the purposeful, more deliberate exercise side of things if you want to do more than walking. And so really, when we get down the chain, we eventually just get to, how many calories do you eat? How much protein do you consume? And how much low intensity activity do you get in? In other words, how much do you walk? And again, like, we can go 20 or 30 steps on before we even get to, like, all right, I must have this 50 gram frozen wheatgrass cube steeped in whatever. So when we talk about longevity, I really care about, like, if you fall over, do you break a bone? You know what kills people? Getting bedridden. Weakness. Literal weakness in this case. Weakness of the bones, weakness of the muscles, poor coordination. And you can develop all that stuff totally tangential to diet, frankly. And so I look at, like, what sort of things do we want to really prioritize here? Do we want to prioritize how long I keep my heart beating? One thing. How long I stay useful? Another thing. I tend to prioritize that. So the whole idea of, like, developing healthy patterns and then prioritizing protein. And at that point, you can get a person yourself down to a healthy, like a legitimately healthy body fat or body mass. And then at that point, once a person makes those huge jumps from, like, oh my goodness, I can hardly manage anything in my life, to, like, okay, now I've reached a legitimately healthy body mass, I have all these other things in place. At that point, a person will have already developed the taste buds for vegetables once in a while. Almost every time. And even if not, like, they can still happen down the line. But by and large, if a person starts to get progress in the ways they like doing it, they will develop interest in that thing, Doug. And when they develop interest in that thing, it raises the probability that we'll start experimenting in that domain. And thankfully, experimenting within the domain of nutrition tends to involve things like cooking. It tends to involve things like trying new foods. It tends to involve all of these other things that many professionals try to force on people at the very beginning. And so, to answer the original question of how do you get a person interested in this stuff, I will tell you straight up, people tend to get interested in things they get good at, man. And you get good at things in the order it makes sense to develop the skill. And if somebody starts something new and they hate it, you've probably gone in the wrong order.
A lot of times you'll hear people say, okay, aim for 1 gram per pound of body weight and protein, 30 grams of fiber, 5 servings of vegetables, X amount of water. And people can sometimes get lost in that because they're trying to go from like step 1 to step 25. Your approach, it seems like you're just trying to get somebody to pay attention to where they're at, understand why it's important for them to move, to keep the ball moving forward, and then figure out ways for them to slowly and incrementally progress along that continuum so that eventually maybe they get to that point where they're checking all those boxes that I kind of mentioned at the beginning. You talked about developing healthy patterns. Define what that is and how can somebody begin to work on those?
Great question. I honestly define a healthy pattern as a consistent one, by and large. And so, you know, people can argue about this till the cows come home. And what else do people do about it besides argue? I care more that you do a similar thing every day than you do a particular thing every day. And so I call the milestone method. Basically, we all have junction points in our day where it makes sense to eat, right? The person, Doug, doesn't have time to do anything, they manage to eat, right? And even if it means doing it here in this spot at this time, you still have a junction point where you have something like you can put your body in a space to do this stuff. So, you know, even down to the nurses who like, I only got 10 minutes to go to the bathroom. So I eat food in there sometimes. For people that have freakishly busy jobs, lots of experience in that realm too, to which I reply, great, better than the alternative of hating your life and dying. So in situations like this, man, I really see healthy patterns as something, as a pattern that you can stick to on a day-to-day basis. With some, like, we have breathing room, of course, but really, like, can you eat 3 times or 2 times or 4 times? At around the same time of day. And that, by and large, once you've accumulated enough data, like, okay, for a month or two or whatever, I know that like these 3 times per day, I can get a meal in. Freaking awesome. And I see that as a healthy pattern, frankly. A pattern I see as a healthy pattern, by and large. And when you now know that you have these times in your day where you have now trained yourself, because this also trains your organs, this helps with your circadian rhythms, etc. Like you have trained essentially your endocrine system to eat at these times of day. At that point now, when you have that down, you now have the breathing room to start making your life a little more complicated. And so these things that people do, when I say stacking things on, it takes a lot of brain power, even if they look simple, to do all this stuff at once. And I care so much about mastering skills in a particular order and waiting until you've mastered or gotten fluent before moving on. Because once you've mastered a skill, how much brain power does it take to perform?
Right. Not as much.
Not as much. And so we can end up stacking these healthy habits up to high heaven because each one has the tiniest or even zero incremental cost. Because if something is a cost of 1 and then you master it and then it goes to a cost of 0.05, well, then when you add another thing, a cost of 1, it has the same practical addition as the first one. And so it has less to do with you want to add things in baby steps and do it in this order at this time. I care more about fluency of the skill, making empirical adjustments. In other words, it makes sense to go to the next skill when you've mastered this one. I care about people mastering this skill before that one, because the amount of effort it takes to perform the skill goes down. It has very little to do with like the mysteries of mastery and more that like you actually have less brain activation when you've mastered a skill, when you've learned a thing.
I know one of the skills that you think somebody should master on a daily basis, not outside of consistency, is self-awareness, tracking their food, paying attention to what they eat. Outside of that, if somebody's listening to this, they're like, Dr. Kashi, what you're saying, I'm really resonating with. I love this approach where I'm just slowly progressing along this continuum, but there's a lot of information out there. I should eat a lot of protein. I shouldn't eat protein. I should eat animal foods. I shouldn't eat animal foods. I should eat beans. I shouldn't eat beans. What's another skill that you think when it comes to nutrition that you think somebody should really focus on mastering outside of the self-awareness piece?
Very good. So in this situation, I love to start the conversation with a lot of the, you know, should I eat this? Should I eat that? Et cetera. I always start first and foremost, you made it this far. You made it this far. And I mean, I get emotional saying that, dude. Like, first thing I do, I validate that the person already has sufficient skills to keep themselves alive and kicking. How do I know? Because they sit here and talk to me right now. And so very first thing, Doug, you made it this far. If you had done anything that wrong, would you have made it this far? Now, we could all do things better. Asterisk, you have done good enough. You have kept yourself alive. You've probably raised kids. You probably keep, you know, you have a lot of stuff on board already. And so I like to take advantage of those. And so in this case, once I've developed the self-awareness, then they develop the healthy eating patterns. At that point, I start just focusing on protein. Again, I still care about just eat the foods you like to eat. We can do better. We can also do good enough. I see them as two separate things. And a lot of people think like good enough equals failing for whatever freaking stupid reason. But really, good enough is good enough. You can do good enough and you can do better. And so the next step involves getting enough protein in, really from whatever sources you like. I tend to like variety, the animal products, not, you know, plant products, whatever synthetic products even. I see that as really secondary or tertiary in the grand scheme of things too. Do you get enough metabolizable nitrogen? So we started earlier in the conversation with metabolizable carbon, primarily what we use to store energy. Now we go to the metabolite. Do you get the amino acids? As a biochemist, I frankly care very little where the amino acids themselves come from. That you get them from a nutritive source of some sort. We just look at, have you got enough protein? And if you can keep track of what you eat, whether you eat a lot or a little, if you can keep track of it, you can eat at regular amounts at regular times every day, and you can eat enough protein, Doug, you've won. Like that gives you the 90-10. It really does. Now, this other stuff that we inundate people with, these sort of like, what do marketers call them? Unique value propositions, these sort of mechanisms that people sort of fabricate to make this look interesting. Like the 80-20 or even the 90-10 just comes down to like, do you eat enough to support your goal? Do you walk around once in a while? Do you have enough protein? And from a vast majority of people, that will put you in a healthy zone. Could you get healthier? Probably. This will get you good enough. And once those things get mastered, then it gets to a point where like, okay, we can home in on something now more interesting to you. Because now just arbitrarily changing like, okay, you must get this many vegetables in at this time, et cetera, then it does turn into that tuna and twig problem I like to avoid. At that point, I like to direct someone towards something more physical, something related to something physical that they can use to push themselves, that the changes in nutrition will help by tangent. So for some people, it might mean like, let's do a 5K. Let's enter a volleyball competition. Let's do something where you've made this new body for yourself. Let's use it. And so at that point, I start focusing more on deliberate, more specific physical activity, things that people like to do that sets a different sort of goal to sort of change the flavor for a minute. And when you realize, oh, I start prepping for a 10K or a 5K or some CrossFit event or something, these other changes, kind of like we spoke about earlier about the observer effects, other changes will start to occur sort of automatically when you start to gear up to do something that you look forward to doing for fun. And so then we ask the question, what sounds fun to do? Oh, imagine that, Doug. Let's find something fun to do and let's plan to do that together. And in preparation for doing that fun thing, a lot of this other stuff, these nuanced things end up taking care of themselves because now they start to develop another skill. They start to get good at this other stuff. And part of getting good at that other stuff might involve more complicated meal timing. It might involve taking a dietary supplement. It might involve sort of accidentally some of these other things that people might try to force, when really we can just make it a sort of a side effect of preparing to do something more fun in the future.
And so for somebody who's listening to this, that they're saying, all right, this all makes sense to me. I'm going to start incorporating more protein into my day, into my diet. But now I want to find a skill, a physical skill that I can work on mastering, that I can get excited about. I'm already strength training. I'm already, you know, at the gym regularly. 5K sounds great, but that's a few months from now. What's something that they can do on a daily or a weekly basis or whatever that you find will be very beneficial to the masses?
So I love to ask people three questions. You want to get fast, bendy, or strong? And I use those as my three basic domains of initial fitness progression. I see you want to get fast, bendy, or strong. Obviously, you can get all of them. I know this. We know this. I care about, ooh, what sounds most interesting to you? Fast, bendy, or strong? And a person will immediately, like, okay, like of all types, like, and you might get very surprised at the answer you get from the sort of people. You might just expect something different. And so I love it when just the massive dude wants to get bendy, or the 70-year-old woman wants to get strong. Like, I love, like, you get that a lot. And so, like, for instance, a lot of, like, gender stereotyping, for instance, a lot of people feel forced to do things that they hate doing because men do this and girls do that or whatever. But by the time we get to that point, it's just like, tell me what you like. We can do that thing. When you get good at it, life will get better. I promise. Like, and I have seen huge, big men do the splits, and it looks funny and awesome and amazing and everything you want it to. And I've seen 70-year-old ladies deadlift a lot. And so in these sort of situations, I care, like, fast, bendy, or strong. And then we can get more nuanced as we go. But again, this gets the ball rolling. Well, then we can say, how fast? For how long? What kind of strong? Right? It progresses a different kind of conversation. But really, it just comes down to fast, bendy, or strong. You immediately get, like, okay. And then from there, you kind of get agreement about the domain. And then you say, okay, what happens? And then as a fitness professional or a health professional or coach or whatever, you kind of already have an idea of the sort of progressions that occur. And if not, it behooves you to know what sort of progressions occur, how fast they occur, especially for the age group and prior history. And you just start out with something that, using their feedback, they will enjoy doing. They already have a high state of motivation, relatively speaking, because you know they have interest in it. And they start now prioritizing that thing a little bit more. If you have some due date or some deadline or something you want to do in the future about that thing, that also works as a fantastic motivating operation, at least in the beginning, right? And it also, frankly, helps devise a training plan insofar as you can work with this person and say, okay, we have this thing 14 weeks away. We can make a training plan 14 weeks long that will progress you towards this. And as we progress, we can actually show, we can actually measure the differences in your body as we go. And then we can make a reasonable projection of how you will perform on that day. And so I know I rambled a little bit, but fast, bendy, or strong, brother. Like, I just go there.
And so I feel like we've taken people along this health, wellness, nutrition, fitness continuum pretty far. And that if they're doing these things and they're at this point, then they're doing pretty good. They're doing better than most people. And I feel like people will listen to this and then they'll be like, this all makes sense. And then they'll get on social media and they'll get lost. They'll get confused. And they'll be like, wait, this person says that. This person says that. Obviously, I don't want to get into specific people, but generally speaking, what are some of the biggest misconceptions that you see people believing time and time again online that you're constantly having to talk people out of?
Okay, so you bring up a great question. I've done this long enough that now I've, like, so many come in and out of Vogue. I don't know, like, I will tell you that I like to talk about the individual person here, and so bear with me. I bring up what I have called, probably as another fancy name, I call it the Bruce Lee fallacy. So have you ever heard of that quote from Bruce Lee? I may as well look it up here to do exactly what he says. Bruce Lee gets attributed to saying, absorb what is useful, reject what is useless, and add what is essentially your own. Have you heard this or something like it?
I have not.
Okay, so take the good stuff, leave the bad stuff, and put your own twist on it. Does that make sense, though? It makes a lot of sense, except we have one problem. Only Bruce Lee can do that. And so when people get on social media, by and large, dude, by and large, any individual person has decent enough things to say. By and large. Now, when you follow 200 people and or 2,000 people and you try and like take these little points here, there, and everywhere and combine them into your own super mega, like now we have a problem. Because Bruce, only Bruce Lee has the mastery to absorb the useful stuff and reject the useless stuff. When we do it, us mortals, knowing nothing about all of this stuff, we just look at what seems the most interesting rather than the most effective. And so we end up getting this conglomeration of lore that we saw like, ooh, that looks cool, that looks cool, that looks cool, and combining it all together and then really confusing ourselves. And so again, I agree with pointing out nobody in particular. I do think that the popular, I get questions about the most popular thing, right? And by and large, the popular thing, even though it might have sketchy mechanisms, if somebody just followed the suggestion, it would probably get them closer to what they wanted. Again, by and large, right? Arguing about mechanisms of action and it like nobody tends to really argue about the results they get. They just argue about how it works, and the how it works part comes down to the marketing. And so very few people really argue that much about the data. They tend to argue about how people market the data. And so for me, when I talk with somebody one-on-one, or when you talk to yourself about it, like, do you take the Bruce Lee approach? Ooh, that looks neat. I like that. I like that. I like that. I'm going to point all this together and try and create a super awesome mega plan that does this like it would have worked already, so to speak. And so the misconceptions here, I kind of see so what, who cares? As in, like, we can say that, like, some magical keto god comes down and sucks the fat out of your belly. Like, okay, fine. Does it annoy me as a biochemist? Sure. But like, why? Kind of like when somebody says, oh, I just want to get toned. And what does a personal trainer go? Oh, there's no such thing as tone. I kind of see it as the same thing. I just care that you have any interest at all at making your life better. And that if you start to see progress doing the things that you do, then it raises the probability that you continue doing it. If you have, or I have, some technical deficiencies in the explanation, well, that occurs even at the highest level of science.
Right. Don't you think that, but we've talked a lot about behavioral science and cognitive science throughout the course of this episode. And one of the main themes, I think, has been that you can't go from, most people can't go from chapter one to chapter 25 on their fitness journey. Most people can't just say, I'm going to cut out everything, incorporate these things, do these things when they're starting off. I think what you see a lot of, though, on social media is that thing, in that, sure, people can say, okay, I'm going to do that thing. And maybe they start and that gets them a little bit excited, but they're also setting themselves up for failure because it's just completely unrealistic to go all organic, cut out all processed foods, eat the protein, go for the walks, do all the things. How can somebody bridge those two things where they're getting excited from what they see online, but they're also kind of trying to remember what we've been talking about throughout this conversation?
Very good, man. I go back to commitment devices a little bit here. Like, do you have to follow all these fitness people? Must you, should you, or else? And that I see, honestly, when people ask me that, they kind of answer their own question. They see, I see all of this confusing crap from all these millions of people online, to which Dr. Cashy can only reply, why do you follow millions of people online saying confusing things? And so we can go a little bit back to the commitment device of like, tell me the last time you've cleaned out your social media closet, where you've actually curated who you want to pay attention to. And by virtue of trying to follow this person and that person and that person, we've gone back and fallen into the Bruce Lee trap again. And as far as like, ooh, this person looks interesting, I wonder what they have to say. Ooh, I like that. Now we've fallen into the Bruce Lee trap. And so I hesitate to say any particular person or way. I do think that if you find yourself confused because of all of the information flying around, you probably follow a lot of sources of information that say confusing things. And that I recommend literally prompting a sort of closet clean out situation. I think I like to depend on, you know, my bias. I like books. I like books that say reasonable things. I tend to like older books. Thankfully, the principles of nutrition have stayed about the same for like the past 60 years. And so the new fandangled thing only looks new and fandangled because somebody has fabricated different language to describe something that has already existed a long time ago. And so this whole idea of like, I'd say if you get your fitness information off of social media, well, then we kind of already have a conversation to have about that. And so the where you get your sources matters. Again, the palatability of the source matters. And although I do see by and large social media content entertaining, nobody will learn how to run their lives in 30-second chunks, Doug. And if you try, it will look like it.
I feel like a big reason that people follow certain people online is because they feel like they can relate to them. They feel that they're relatable. And I think that in many ways, that's what can really make a great coach-client relationship is just finding ways to relate to them. You don't have to necessarily always put yourself in their shoes. But I want to get into your story a little bit because I feel like people, they're probably very not only feeling educated, but they're also feeling kind of entertained and inspired by some of the things you're having to say. But things haven't always been easy for you. I'd love for you to, as comfortable as you are, open up about some of your own struggles and battles with your own mental health and how you managed to crawl your way out of it.
Okay. So I will just flat out say I took some medication as a young kid, I want to say 12 or so, for a skin condition. And that medication had a side effect of suicidal thoughts. And so I only knew this sometime later. And it turns out I drew the long stick on that one. I got lucky. And so probably about the age 11 or 12 or so, like I learned suicide existed on accident. And that then turned into this sort of an existential irritation, I'll call it, like the nature of existing. And my mother, bless her, has a formal education in philosophy. And so sort of before I knew that at all, or what that meant, I basically said like, Mom, I have all these problems. There's no point to anything. And she said, I know. There isn't. And so that created a sort of interesting, I'll just call it interesting path for me, where I just like severe sort of existential crisis issues. Also, I had a sort of strange academic chronology. I went through school very early. I graduated very early. And like fast forward a little bit, I ended up having going into self-harm, basically. And in the meantime, I also spent some time in the psychiatric ward for a couple of months at some other place. I will leave out exactly. We're already getting sweaty talking about it. That basically just came down to like, I have stayed very interested in science my entire life. And I started asking very difficult questions to myself and other people about things regarding life that nobody has the answers to. And I had my own sort of meltdown of like, nobody knows these things. What is the point? And at that point, I got sensitized to a lot of daily hassles. And so a lot of stuff that like I could have blown off or ignored, that I had this sort of glasses on of like, there's no point to life. Every time I incurred like even a daily hassle, it just sort of elevated to the point of like, I had a hard time managing my day-to-day operations. And so I ended up turning to self-harm a lot to manage my stress, anger, depression, et cetera. That ended up catching up with me at my early times at university. And when I spent an extended period of time in a psychiatric facility, and at that point, I mostly just got drugged to high heavens almost the entire time I went I waited like, I'm going to say 10 days or longer before I even saw a physician. And so I had such a bad experience in that. I had such a bad experience there that when I got released, checked out, whatever you want to call it, I had this sort of epiphany and went like, I'm a scientist. I can apply the scientific method to these things, even though I had relied on, you know, asking ridiculous questions before, when getting treated, none of it felt very scientific to me. I think maybe four times a day, someone came around to check my blood pressure because I got so sedated. They want to see I had breathed, but really when I started, like, what in my surroundings contributed to this stuff? What immediately, what in the past, what sort of things can I do? Can I change in my daily operations to see, like, I know in these situations I act this way. And so that gives you two options. You can avoid the situation or you can try to modify it in some way. And so when I started getting into studying mental health and behavior and having the science and nutrition background, that sort of, it sort of turned into this serendipitous sort of situation where I worked with people on accident, and it just turned into this big learning experience for me where I could work with people and also work with myself at the same time and figure out just what it meant to have a life worth living, so to speak, that I would say, you know, even now I have these sort of existential issues. I still have these creeping black thoughts, and I just know that these occur. It gets easy to say that these occur randomly, and they just don't. And so, for instance, I have noticed a direct correlation in how much sleep I get and how often I have intrusive suicidal thoughts. And so when I notice that correlation, I immediately, like, anything that interrupts or keeps me from sleeping, I just say no. Because I know the less I sleep, the more I want to hurt myself. And so when I started, you know, analyzing and looking back at all of these really manipulable factors, I could create this sort of sort list for myself where, like, if I know all of these things contribute to me feeling bad, well, how do I do the inverse of all of those things? And it turned into a very systematic approach to manipulating my environment and my behavior and taking measurements and doing all the things a scientist does and other people refuse to do, which I try to encourage as much as I can. But I can only speak from my own experience here that if you want to get to point B, I recommend you find point A. And if you know point A and point B, that makes it easier to plot a course. And although people tend to agree when you talk about that in conversation, in practice, it takes a little bit of effort. And so I did spend a long time figuring all of that stuff out, and it ended up working out okay for the most part. Does that sort of answer the question, or do you have any more specific details you'd like to know about?
Well, I'd love to double click on a couple things there. I first wanted to say thanks, man, for sharing all that. I know it's not easy to share stuff like this, you know, when you're not talking about it a lot. I know you talked a little bit about some of the emotions that were coming up or the physical sensations of just even talking about this stuff. Curious, like, you mentioned how you applied the scientific method to essentially really transform your mental health, I guess, and manipulate circumstances, surroundings, habits, stuff like that. What were some of the things that you've done and continue to do other than prioritizing sleep that keep you on this path of, you know, staying out of despair?
It honestly took a long time to me to figure out if I stopped obsessing about myself and paid more attention to the environment, I have a much better chance. So people get sad or depressed or anxious, they go internal. Like, my feelings cause me to do all of these things. I'm out of my mind. Like, we get solipsistic. We start self-obsessing. And like, you know, that makes a lot of sense. I feel these bad things. This bad stuff occurs. Therefore, my bad feelings cause this bad stuff. And when, just frankly, analyzing this stuff, we just ask the question, well, what causes that bad feeling to occur? And most people stop at, well, it just happens. And for me, it really just came down to, if I start to feel bad, do I, like, obsess over myself about this bad feeling, or do I immediately survey the environment in the last 30 or 45 minutes to see what could have contributed to this ick? And that vigilance has made a massive difference. And if I can do something about the ick or this environmental change, I absolutely will. And if I can't, well, I've gotten to the point now where I can, like, I will survive. This will suck and I will live. And a lot of it has to do with forming these sort of positive conjunctive statements where instead of saying that life sucks, I can't take it anymore, this can't be happening, you shouldn't do this, I form these really just conjunctive statements of this sucks and I can do it. And so I do a combination of like, I also reject this sort of affirmative, these affirmations of like, you can do it, like nothing matters, you're the best, versus like, life is meaningless, who cares? I just sort of combine those two things of like, yeah, this thing feels crummy and I'll survive. Sort of validating that things can suck because sucky things can suck. It makes sense for sucky things to suck. I would rather sucky things suck because that helps us modify our behavior to make them better. Different from ignoring them or sort of a lot of these mindfulness techniques try to convince you to get used to bad stuff, which I also see as kind of stupid if you can modify it. So really it just comes down to a level of self-prompting that now that I have these other experiences, I now have the skills sort of developed on accident of, okay, this thing occurred in like the last hour, this sucks, and I can manage. And 95% of the time, that does plenty. And then the rest of the time, I take case by case. So really, it just, that keeps it going. We all have black thoughts. Like some equivalent sort of dark, stupid crap that happens with all of us for whatever reason. We form these relational frames arbitrarily, different conversation. But basically, it just comes down to just because this thought appeared, does that mean I have to follow its directions? And does it also mean I have to do a deep dive into the depths of my mind to figure out whether or not I have an Oedipus complex or whatever? It just, a lot of it comes down to like, if you wait long enough, it'll go away. For a lot of the stuff that doesn't, there you go to modify these external factors to at least give yourself a fighting chance.
Bringing things together a little bit, combining what you just shared, which was awesome, and what we've been talking about throughout the conversation, in the context of nutrition, health transformation, one of the thoughts that people have a hard time not reacting to impulsively is when they get stressed and they want to eat, right? And they'll say, oh, I'm feeling stressed, so it's okay to eat a pint of ice cream because I've had a bad day, right? Not to say that you can't eat some unhealthy things, but if you do that on a regular basis, you're teaching yourself that, you know, you can't be uncomfortable. You're teaching yourself that when things get hard, you engage in an unhealthy pattern or behavior that's against your values and what you want for yourself. I know you talk a lot about this stuff. How can somebody have a better relationship with stressful eating?
I do think that I love to do terminology sort of breakdowns here that like the fact that somebody calls it stress eating already establishes that as this sort of operant, like you've already like turned it into a thing that exists, so to speak. And so I like to immediately separate things and say, sometimes you feel stressed, sometimes you eat, sometimes you eat while stressed. And this may sound silly, but I feel like that level of nuance helps in a one-to-one situation because stress eating turns into it basically turns into a skill, right? You use it to manage this sort of stressful situation. And so just by putting stress and eating in the same breath, you literally prompt yourself on a frequent basis to eat when you feel icky. And so I try to focus on separating out whatever sort of physiological status or interoceptive stimulus you describe, and then what you do to manage that thing. And so we really ask the question now of, we do the chain analysis. We ask the question of, well, under what conditions did this stress occur? What happened in the last 20, 30 minutes or hours or whatever? And that you know you do this on a regular basis, how can we make it essentially a lower probability that it occurs and a higher probability something else occurs? Because we can just as easily ask the question from a commitment standpoint, if you make it easy to stress eat, it raises the probability you do it. And so I just like to start with, If you make it easy for you to do, it will happen more often. If you make it more difficult to do, it will happen less often and or at a lower probability. And then if you add your own interfering factor in, Like now I have an alternative. I've made it more difficult to stress eat and I've made it easier to do something else. You've now sort of loaded the dice a little bit in your favor. And so I try to stay away from like, let's talk through all of the deep, dark feelings and all this. Like you get an ick and you have ice cream. Like, do we really have to make it more complicated than that right now? If the ice cream vanished, what would happen? Would you die? Would you explode? Would your brains end up all over the wall? Or would you feel ick for about 30 seconds and it'd probably go away on its own anyway? And so we have a lot of like irreverent conversations like this. I tend to, again, I do very little in the way of like trying to handhold or head pat of like, you stress eat because you feel stressed and have food around. And this whole like, I must stress eat or else, this sort of hardcore language makes it appear as if, well, if I don't eat, my brains will end up all over the wall. Will that really happen? No. What do you think would happen? Well, I'd probably feel stressed for a minute and get frustrated. And then like, well, what, like, I guess it would figure itself. Yeah, it would probably figure itself out. So I like to bring up the question of, well, what happened if you did something else instead? And like opening up the conversation that way, basically. Because again, we make up these stories, like just the term stress eat. I've already developed this relationship sort of deliberately between this internal status and having and this other external behavior that has delayed negative consequences. And so now we ask the question of like, what would actually happen if you just sat on your hands? It's just a general question. Like, do you really think you would obsess over ice cream for the next 62 years and or you died of starvation? Again, depending on the person, I have a different, you know, sort of tone, you know, depending on the rapport. But it ends up going kind of like just first glance, like what would happen if you did nothing? And then again, going through the motions of, well, under what conditions does this have a higher probability of occurring? How do we manipulate those conditions? Because you can. How do we install commitment devices to make it more difficult to do that? And then how do we install other commitment devices to make it easier to do something else? Like if you feel the ick, you could go outside, call mom and go for a walk. Because if you'll spend 15 minutes sitting on the couch eating, you could spend 15 minutes talking to somebody who loves you. Make it a little more difficult to do this and a little bit easier to do that. Load the dice in your favor a little bit and give yourself a fighting chance to see the benefits of those sorts of interventions. And of course, having somebody else with you along the way helps tremendously. That just sort of gives you a very general, like, how do we make it a little bit more difficult to do the problem thing, a little bit easier to do the alternative, and then try to install an alternative where you can see immediate benefits as well.
So so as far as making things more difficult and making something else and doing something else easier, is the thing you most commonly recommend, generally speaking, is it, you know, if somebody gets stressed, they eat ice cream, is it okay? No more, you know, no ice cream in the freezer. And, or if there's ice cream in the freezer, like go for a walk, call somebody that cares about you. Or is there something else that you would recommend to somebody as a general rule?
So as a general rule, I do say like, you can have ice cream, whatever you want. You can just make it more irritating to get. And so very, very big difference between you can never have ice cream when you're stressed versus you make ice cream freely available at all times. And so like, if it means you go to the gas station to get a pint, it still puts a pause. So you can go eat ice cream and you feel stressed. I just recommend you make it a little more difficult to do so that on your way to driving to the gas station, you go, do I really want to do this? And sometimes you might. And in that case, okay, we have a different conversation to have. I would say a good portion of the time, creating a little bit of space in the way of time. Like, yes, you still have ice cream. We just want to make it a little more difficult to eat. Yes, I know that you can call mom, or your sister or your friend or whatever, whoever, and make it a little more convenient to do. And so again, it has very little to do with hard and fast rules and more like, well, if how do we just make these little changes to the environment, these nudges that just shift the probability a little bit. I tend to do away with hard and fast rules. I make the recommendation that if you tend to overeat pre-made food when you get really stressed and you have pre-made food around, it raises the probability you will eat pre-made food when stressed. If you cook during meal times, well, then it makes it more difficult to eat pre-made food when you feel stressed out. And so, oh, but this causes other interference and makes it irritating, whatever, which I agree, it gets into a totally different one-on-one conversation. Because if you do meal prep and then you eat it all when you feel stressed out, you got to do the meal prep again anyway. So the time component immediately falls in on itself. And so, again, it has to do with the sort of rapport I have with the person. So seldom have I seen people, you know, binge eat 5 pounds of baked chicken and a head of cabbage. It has happened, but low probability.
I've done that before.
Well, me, I have too. I've only done it once, yeah. Although I have done it. And again, like if we compared to the amount of times I have binge eaten in my life, a few, very few of them occur with these other modestly palatable foods, like things that taste good when you get hungry. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Some things still taste good when you feel full. I kind of use that as also a different sort of metric for myself and other people as well, that like when the plain baked potato tastes good, you know you've gotten hungry. If you wonder like, who, what do I eat for lunch? Wait. Because eventually that potato will sound good. So again, it's sort of a, you know, taking a left there a little bit, but hopefully that sort of gives you an idea of the way I like to approach those things. Again, I just look in terms of probability. I see all these outputs as probabilistic. And how do we just load the dice a little bit in our favor?
So stress seems to be a common roadblock that gets into people's way as far as having this health transformation that they're looking for. I would say another big roadblock is plateaus. You know, somebody's seeing progress, all of a sudden scale's not moving in the direction that they like. Clothes aren't fitting in the way that they think they would. How do you keep people on track when they're frustrated with a plateau?
So I will tell you that plateaus, the way I do things, tend to occur very far in the game. So because of the way that I install these steps, like I know that once we install this, some progress will occur. Once we install that, some progress will occur. Once we install this, some... And so the plateau that you talk about happens 6-8 months in or longer. And at that point, the person has already developed a lot of the tolerance to, you know, spikes in the scale. They understand, well, if I eat beans, I know I'll gain 3 pounds the next day. And I know that I retained water, for instance. And so in this context of like, when we get to that sort of status of a plateau, at that sort of situation, I install, if I have yet to, I start installing a different sort of alternative physical goal. And so seldom does somebody's body weight stall and also some other alternative fitness metric stall at the same time. And so basically the more ways you measure, you can measure, the more ways you can win. And it really just comes down to if you only use the scale to measure progress, you will lose. And so if the body weight stalls, what else do you have? If you only have that, then that makes your life very difficult unless you have a long history of knowing how to interpret that longitudinal data from the scale. And so, and then typically 6-8 months in, when this sort of plateau starts to occur, a lot of times they go, oh yeah, I know I have a FODMAP thing. I ate some cabbage and some beans. I gained 4 pounds. I know it'll take 7 days to come off. I can like, I'll manage. And so these plateaus that people have when they occur in like week 4, because they've made these massive changes to their diet, they've cut out all the carbs and sugar and whatever else, and they have this massive water weight dump. And then their body weight stays relatively stable. Then they get irritated and then they binge and then say, I'm not making progress. Well, I agree. And so if you have the progress occur frequently rather than a lot, the issue with plateauing tends to go away. It honestly does. And even when it does occur, which sometimes it does, we've installed other sort of metrics in place to show that you still make progress.
Last question I have is, goes back to your story a bit and how you deal with things. And, in the recovery world, being of service and helping other people is like a big cornerstone for helping people recover from addiction and improve their mental health and just stay well-rounded, right? Cause when you're feeling crappy about yourself, it's easy just to help somebody else. Or one of the things that you do is you help somebody else and then you tend to feel better, right?
Yeah, correct.
You seem so passionate about what you do and helping other people and just seeing people change, and you get excited about this, as people can tell. Is helping others and doing what you do, is this part of the solution that helps you with your mental health?
It makes life worth living.
Yeah.
Yeah. It makes life worth living. Mm. Period.
Yeah.
Period. Mm. I care too much. I care too much to fiddle fart around all this stupid crap people argue about, man.
Yeah.
Like, how many bites of chicken after the third set of leg extensions and the vernal equinox of the moon? Eating this testicle? Like, athletic greens? Like, just go for a walk, man. I'll talk to you. You know? Like, just, I care way too much to get caught up in that stuff. Like, I just, like, let me love you. Just let me love you. None of this stuff matters, and you know it. And you came to me because you know it. Like, I know you know it because you talk to me right now. You know, talking to the person I talk to. Like, we all know. If you want to BS about something else, fine. If you want an excuse to talk to me about other things, fine. So again, I go on a little bit of a tangent because I got obviously stimulated by that question. But really, it honestly makes life living for me. And I can only speak for myself.
I love that, man. Thanks so much for sharing that. And I think that's a great way to end our combo. Dr. Kashi, this has been awesome. I've gotten so much value out of this conversation, and I think my audience is going to as well. If people want to learn more about your work, learn more about your business, connect with you, where's the best place to do that?
Honestly, you can go to trevorkashinutrition.com, and we will talk to anybody who schedules a call.
Awesome.
Like a human. We will talk to you. So I recommend going there. You can, you know, at Dr. Kashi at, you know, the general areas, but honestly, like, go to trevorkashinutrition.com. You can talk to a human, and we'll let you know. You let us know, and we'll let you know.
Amazing, man. Well, I highly encourage everybody to go check out your site. You're great at what you do. I really value your insight, your work, and your passion for helping others. So thanks again for coming on the show, man. I think people are going to really love this episode.
Thank you so much.